This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 27th of December, 1951. The title of this lecture is Counter Emotion. This lecture is 56 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
The line of advance of Dianetic Processing has been actually very consistent. Let me give you the parallel. Dianetics took off from the knowledge of modern medicine. In some cases, I think well in advance of the knowledge of modern medicine. Because one wasn't burdened down, or I wasn't burdened down, let's be blunt, with a bunch of postulates about how he didn't come to me too soon and so forth. I already assumed that modern medicine could do something for somebody. Mistake. Modern medicine can do something for somebody as long as they use biochemistry, penicillin, oreomycin, sulfa, quinine. You can put somebody out of pain with the various sedatives. They need to be coached up enormously before they're on the ball with obstetrics because they aren't getting healthy babies born. And that's the purpose of obstetrics. Somebody ought to tell them. Because we've got too many cases now of babies born Dianetics-wise that just come up beaming and beautiful. I'll bet you that if you took a maternity ward, 100 women in it, and one baby that had been born with preventive Dianetics very definitely in mind, bet you I could pick out the mother and the baby at a glance. Maybe you haven't had much to do with maternity wards. It's a pretty grim business. The last one I went through, over 50% of the women there had been damaged needlessly. And we're showing it very markedly. About a third of them had heavy postpartum neuroses, and one a postpartum psychosis. Fascinating business. So we shouldn't do this in this society. You know, this is our society. This is yours and mine. It doesn't belong to anybody else any less than it does to us. Something we're liable to forget when we're fighting a minority action. That minority action is getting up stronger and stronger, and less of a minority action. So, we want to see the next generation snapping into it, healthier. A lot of these diseases prevented, you can just take off right there from obstetrics. The next is orthopedics. The patching up of the bones. And the next is emergency surgery. Now, I knew these techniques fairly well. I say it quite honestly, because they aren't very hard to learn. We didn't have any babies born on our Corvettes. We sure had everything else. And I objected to men being at sea for 6 weeks without any further medical attention. Bureau of Medicine and Surgery gives the captain of a Corvette all of the textbooks he thinks he needs on the subject. They don't limit him. And they give him, he can go up to a hospital and say, I'm skipper of the so-and-so, and they'll hand you out anything you want, practically, at least during wartime. We had no doctor. I was on ship for a long time as the only one. Pharmacist mate was generally a kid who had come in and had been made third class because they didn't have any hospital apprentices to promote immediately. And he was made third class, and then he was made second class because there weren't enough second classes. And then he was promoted first class immediately afterwards so that he could go to sea because the law said that he had to be a first class in order to go to sea in a solitary post as the one pharmacist made on a ship. But those kids had manuals. A lot of them had brains. I've seen some very remarkable things. As far as medicine is concerned, then Dianetics was begun with the assumption that more was known than was known, that results were better than they are. Because I know, frankly, that the results that were achieved medically on my Corvettes were better than the average results turned out by hospitals. Why? Because we didn't know any better. Now, in addition to that, the Navy is very careful in its indoctrination of what's to be done for what. Their manuals and so forth are very well adhered to. They do not issue, really, a new drug without putting out a rather comprehensive proposition. The Navy, in many ways, like any large organization, may be a bit bureaucratic, but it nevertheless gives you information when you ask for it, and tries to do a good job of it. So Dianetics, as far as a process was concerned, not a philosophy, came out with the understanding that much can be done for the human body on the structural side of the ledger. I just give you that slight background because that was the viewpoint. A lot can be done structurally. You can stick a fellow full of needles and so forth. We hornswoggle people out of being seasick and everything else. Figured out a lot of things. It was a misapprehension because a review of this sort of thing demonstrates that an awful lot of these cases recovered on the mental side of the ledger, not just the physical side of the ledger. Interesting, but true. All right. We go into this technique of application then. We go into the technique of application with the understanding, as its first development, that structure has something to do with it. That you can go in from the structural side and achieve some results. In other words, we backed away from what was known, and rather, we advanced from what was generally known and accepted up a little bit higher. Now, in a reevaluation of what wasn't known, we find out that we were too optimistic. So we start backing up, get a little bit higher than structure. We find out there actually isn't too much there. So the first postulates of the book, the first handbook, stress function. But it's the first graduation from an age-old belief that structure has a lot to do with it. So we go over into the field of function. But we go over into the field of function in the misapprehension of the stimulus response activity, an automatic stimulus response mechanism. Now, this is a person low on the tone scale. He operates this way. This was Dianetics, low on the tone scale and growing. Stimulus response mechanism. Your engram, the key in from the environment, and the operation against the mind of the individual. Nothing, by the way, alters that situation. An individual who is low on the tone scale operates that way. You can still take that sort of thing. Now, the next few discoveries on the thing, which came just in time to get included in the first handbook, had to do with handling emotion. Secondaries. Start blowing secondaries. We find out blowing a secondary has quite a marked effect on an individual. So we say, all right, to quote the first line of the chapter on emotion, emotion is a theta quantity. Not known, but it does something. We graduate up the line from there, and we go into the fact, after that book was published, that straight wire is very often effective. Well, we're up into our first echelon of thought. Now, the next line of advance was handling thought much better as representative in the technique of lock scanning. You can handle thought very rapidly by lock scanning. Big jump. And we begin to examine thought on that echelon, and we find out, for heaven's sakes, after we've summed up these various levels, that it is self-determinism, that an individual who falls for a stimulus response mechanism is low on the tone scale and is not very self-determined. Up above this, you discover self-determinism. And you find out what is the upper level here. The upper level, as far as we can reach it, is self-determinism. Now, this gives us a package that looks like this. We've got three echelons. And backwards, that is to say, as they developed, they consist of structure, which is action or effort. Next echelon is emotion, or the mechanisms of stimulus response. And the next echelon is just ordinary run-of-the-mill thought. Then there's self-determined thought above that, but we'll just take thought as one package. There are actually two steps in thought. Now you see, there's your advance in Dianetics. The advance of Dianetics has paralleled the advance from structure on up to thought. Now the new third echelon, which has not taken place, and which may or may not take place, would have to do with the identification of the overall control of the body, because it's very interesting that these self-determined postulates themselves are actually dependent on former structural action. We already can identify the fact then that there is a prime thought which rides along with the individual all the way through, the prime thought to be. There is an upper action taking place there. But it's very funny. You may, since you knew about postulate processing, you may have gone around thinking to yourself a little bit, thinking, well, I shouldn't make this postulate, and I shouldn't make that postulate, and I should do this and that with regard to this. What's telling you not to make that postulate? Now, you see, that's the boss. That would be the boss mechanism. Something else must be making the postulate. So we're just to that degree inside the third echelon, and that is the borderline. What we're talking about now is what we'll call a second echelon of processing, and this includes effort, emotion, and thought. And believe me, we can handle all three. And that's the first thing you should know. There are three subdivisions, and you should know how those subdivisions are interactive. There is a drawing in the Handbook for Preclears that shows I, and then the motor response mechanism, down here, with the glandular switchboard in between. Now, I puts out an order. It evidently is translated into the physical universe by means of a glandular reaction of some sort. Your thought is an intention, which translates into an emotion, which goes into the switchboard of the body as an effort. Now, your intention and the thought stemming from the intention may go into the motor switchboard immediately, or it may simply become filed as something nice that you imagined. Or there's the reverse mechanism of the physical universe or your environment hitting on the motor level, kicking back up into the glandular level, kicking back up into the thought level. You see how that would be? Well, those three steps. Well, believe me, that's awful simple. That's how thought gets to be action, and how action can kick back and become thought via emotion. Now, we also know pretty well what emotion is. Pretty simple. With an emotional curve, you can certainly manhandle the devil out of emotion these days. You really can by running emotional curves on an individual. You can get some of the doggondest things. Very simple mechanism. It's the change from one level on the tone scale to the other. It's just the emotional curve. Now we find out that the mind is engaged in the estimation of effort. The resolution, the posing, the observations connected with problems and their solution have to do with that central button, estimation of effort. So, Now, the effort could be parked as a future effort, or it can be an immediate effort, or it can merely be an estimated effort to relay by communication to somebody else. Now, your problems resolve on these estimations of effort. Emotion takes place when estimations in direct ratio to the correctness of the estimation of effort. Correctness being a gradient scale. If you were estimating your efforts just beautifully in all directions, believe me, you're happy. But if you're estimating them incorrectly, you go down into the misemotional band. And that is the connection between emotion and thought, and that is the connection between emotion and action. It's right there in the middle. You see, on the one side, it can be balked by counteractions, or it can be interrupted by new intentions. You see how that could be. You walk up to a drawer, you put your hands on the two knobs of the drawer, and it slides open very easily. How much pressure did you have to estimate to put on the handles of that drawer? How much pull did it require for you to slide that drawer open? How much residual tension did there have to be in your body in order that you stood up straight while you opened that drawer? All of these are various estimates of effort. The drawer slides open easily. You're perfectly cheerful. Your tone is not changed at all. You go on and pick up what's in the drawer. That, because it stimulates a thought or something of the sort, might change your tone, if you want it to. But as you open up this drawer, your tone would stay along fellow. But you reach up to the drawer, you start to open the drawer, and you haven't estimated the amount of grip that these two fingers have. And these two fingers slide off the knob. Well, that's that much of a drop. It's a little bit annoyed. You grab a hold of it again, hold it more solidly. And by the way, you probably hold it more solidly than you have to. So you see, a miscalculation of effort in this direction causes you to miscalculate a little bit in that direction. Now, you open the drawer, but as you open the drawer, one side of it sticks. And you say, damn it. The drawer won't open at all. Where do you wind up? You say, well, I didn't want it anyhow. That's apathy. So there's just your range of the tone scale. You can actually take any unsuspecting individual. This is an interesting phenomena. And by the way, this is phenomena hitherto unobserved and stated. Take this individual and put him at an action which you have triggered to go wrong, such as a sticky drawer and slippery handles and so forth, and watch this individual's tone as he starts to handle this drawer. And don't set it up as though it's an experiment. Set it up as though something valuable that he's supposed to have is in that drawer. And then fix it up eventually so the drawer won't open at all. Don't help him out. Watch him go down the tone scale. You'll see him at every step on the tone scale as you go down. So, there is the fellow's estimation of effort, isn't it? But what's the drawer doing? The drawer is doing something. The drawer is the environment. So the drawer is interposing upon him a counter effort. Even if the drawer opens with great smoothness, there is still a counter effort in that drawer. See how that would be? But if it opens very rough, then there is a bad counter effort in the drawer. That is to say, a counter effort in the drawer which inhibits one's emotional response. So, there's effort and counter effort. There's a person trying to make an effort come out, and there is the effort not coming out. Now, the effort which opposes an individual's efforts, we refer to always as counter effort. That's the language. That's counter effort. It could also be called, for your understanding, environmental effort. Every moment of a lifetime has contained in it counter efforts. There's the balances and imbalances of exterior and interior atmosphere. There's 15 pounds per square inch playing all over your body, and there's 15 pounds per square inch inside your body. To balance the 15 pounds per square inch outside of your body, you go up in an airplane, your ears pop. That's just the fact that it's dropped to 13 pounds per square inch outside of your body and stays 15 pounds in or something like that. So your ears have to adjust to it because the eustachian tube is doing that. But your whole body is doing that, and every cell is doing that. And then there's gravity. You always have gravity. First fellow gets in a spaceship somewhere between here and the moon at a zero gravity is going to have an interesting time. Because we actually don't know quite what's going to happen to this individual emotionally. Because he has a certain stability in his gravity. You use gravity. Gravity doesn't use you, but it can use you. Last time you went down the stairs and didn't estimate that there was one more step, gravity gave you quite a shock. The last time you went downstairs and thought there was one more, and there wasn't, that gave you quite a shock too. That would be gravity on a misaligned counter-effort. In other words, that's gravity at non-optimum. When you fall out of an airplane, fall 5,000 feet and splatter, that's non-optimum gravity doing it. All right. Now here's this environmental effort composed of these categories. Your effort to remain at rest or to remain in a state of motion. Your effort to remain at rest or accomplish motion, one should more aptly put it. And the environment's effort to remain at rest or remain in a state of motion. And that's all the conflicts there are in an action category. That's all the conflicts there are. Your effort to remain still when something is trying to move you, and your effort to remain in motion when something is trying to change you or influence you. Now, they're actually start, stop, and change as three categories. But change, don't you see, is just a combination of start and stop. But nevertheless, we'll list them as three categories. So you make a physical effort to remain in a state of rest, to remain in a state of motion, or to change. And the counter effort would be that effort from the environment which inhibits your remaining at a state of rest when you want to, remaining in motion, or inhibits your changing. Counter effort would be the effort which you would have to overcome, but do not necessarily overcome in the environment around you or handle. Now, on emotion is a translator medium. It demonstrates how much activity is necessary to address the situation. It's a monitor, it's a meter. This is the way the body should run at this situation. If it's running low on the tone scale, that means that the conflict between counter effort and effort is getting tremendous. Low on the tone scale. Emotion goes down from zero upset, no upset, no conflict, in other words, down to all conflict. And when it's all conflict, you're dead. And when it's zero conflict, and you've got all these conflicts completely resolved in that degree, I'm talking about now, you've taken off for Valhalla or someplace, in body or something. Now, that would be your two grades on this tone scale. And in the mean between, you have all of these descending reactions. Remember 10 lecture notes? They were worked out before this was fully known, but they were worked out just empirically. They give you a person's responses between action and counteraction, that is, effort and counter-effort. Anger. Anger is an emotion which is trying to hold everything still. You see? Now, before you grade that completely, take a look at this. An angry person, if you try to walk away from him, wants you to come back. If you try to stay near him, he wants you to go away. It's destruction because it's no motion that he's trying to accomplish. Your angry person is trying to destroy. Hammer, pound, yell, scream, do anything you can think of in the line of effort to cause zero counter-effort. Zero counter-effort is what he's trying to accomplish, because zero counter-effort is death. Your angry person destroys. Now, the way you destroy, and the only way you can destroy anything, is cause motion to cease to exist in it. That's the way you destroy. Zero motion is death. You see how that is? You come down to 1-1, you have fear. Now, there's a little demonstration that goes along with this. Let's take anger. Here's the counter-effort reaction to anger. Say, here's this angry person, and here is an environmental effort. And this environmental effort comes along, and it hits this angry person, and it... See? Now, actually, if this succeeds in doing much motion around the angry person, he'll move up and stop it. But the counter effort in motion hitting an angry person causes him to go this way. That comes out this way in effort processing. If you get an individual who is at anger on his intentional level and he is struck by something, you will find him holding that right there, holding it. He's holding the motion. His physical body is actually damping out the motion. He will hold anything in suspension that is in the body. He will try to stop everything in the body. That's where you get calcium deposits. There's your depository illness at 1-5. It's holding motion right still. Person is 1-5 on the tone scale, you have depository illnesses, and that's all there is to it. You can cure him two ways. You can drive him down the tone scale, or you can pull him up. Now, as he drops down the tone scale to fear, motion hits him. He has a tendency to go with the motion a little bit. He is undecided whether to flee or not. It's an indecisive state. But when motion hits in that band, it'll cause a motion. But here's the way it causes the motion. Here's the counter effort. Hits a person who is afraid, or at 1-1 on the band. You see this individual who's afraid. As soon as this counter motion goes away, we'll make sure that it's not going to be there, and then it comes back. The little boy who goes whistling past the graveyard stops often and looks for the ghost. He's ready to flee, but he doesn't quite. But he sure would if there was anything there. In other words, any time a counteraction appeared in the environment, he'd flee. See? So here's your counteraction, and there's covert hostility. That's why covert hostility is there, you see. Motion comes along, and the person says, well, yes, I'm here. I've been put back. See, there's where you get propitiation and so forth. Now, this person is so low on the tone scale that he will go with motion. So there's a certain level there where you get sympathy. In this whole band, you get sympathy. This counteraction is going this way. And you can actually get a person at that point of the tone scale where he can watch that counteraction and start going this way himself. You've ever observed that? Now, you've observed it particularly amongst human beings where one gets nervous and shaky and somebody else gets nervous and shaky too. See how that is? It happens that sympathy can happen on any band of the tone scale. But it must be, we must then define our words a little more correctly, and we'd say that sympathy, as a word, is that which we assign from 1-1 to 0-5 on the tone scale. It's an interchange of misemotion that we will call sympathy. What you want to call the rest of it, I don't care. But everybody in the society appreciates sympathy as being about there on the tone scale. I mean, this is what they think of when they think of sympathy. They think of somebody all gimping along and everybody's sympathetic toward him. Loss in the family, people are sympathetic, and so forth. Now, what they're arguing about on the rest of the band is merely co-action. Somebody's happy, somebody else gets happy. That would be co-action or co-emotional response rather than sympathy. So let's be more precise in our words, since the society was not sufficiently precise before us. All right, grief on the tone scale. Grief on the tone scale is very interesting. It comes back here and it stays there. Do anything you want with a person in grief. Anything you want. Motion hits them, they just go where the motion says. That's grief. But apathy is something else. The person isn't even there. Here's the motion and the counter motion in the environment. See, and it just, this person isn't here. See? Apathy, the motion goes through. Now, you can take a girl and put her in a chair, an apathy case. This case, by the way, may be running on a vivacious sort of a manic or something of the sort. You know, I mean, they appear pepped up every once in a while and so on. They sit in the chair. If they're a real apathy case, and you were to come along and pick up the back end of the chair and tip it, the girl would go right off on the floor. Bomb. In other words, the emotion goes through. They sort of feel like anything goes through them. Their whole virtue is that they can endure. And endure is apathy. If you want to cure an apathy case, give them a run endure out. Give them a run anybody who endured, and themselves enduring, and everything they have to endure, and every time they thought they had to endure, and all the things they've endured, and so forth, and you'll find that they're coming up the tone scale. They're busy enduring. You can endure. Now, you see how motion fits with emotion? Very simple, isn't it? Now, your person in grief won't particularly, they have a tendency to be a little sodden on the apathy edge, but on the upper edge, they merely have a tendency to, if you pick up the chair, they're sitting in the chair, and you pick up the chair, and you dump them, they would have a slight tendency to come up and stand, you see? You know, just stand and then sort of adjust themselves a little bit, particularly if you adjusted them. You can pick up a person's hand in grief and put it up to wipe their eyes, and they'll go on wiping their eyes. Now, a person who is in fear, you come along, you pick up the back of the chair they're sitting in, and you dump it up like this. This person catalyzes the reaction. He does it quicker than you want him to. He comes right up. And then as soon as you aren't watching, he'll sit back down again. If he's in the lower band, the little lower band, they're just below fear, he won't even question you as to why you did it. In apathy, by the way, the first remark is generally, oh, that's all right. They haven't any conception of why you dumped him on the floor. They say, that's all right. Fear, they won't even ask you. But about 2 or 3 minutes later, they will say, you know that last book you wrote? You know, I was talking to a fellow the other day, a good friend. He's all in favor. He's very authoritative and so forth. My, he said it was terrible. He'll get you on one of the three. Now you take anger. Person is sitting there in the chair, and this person is angry, and you come along and you pick up the back of the chair. There they are. They'll sit there. They're not going to be moved. Now we go up the band a little bit and get to 2-0. This person, and we come along, and we start to reach for the chair. And if we start to reach for the chair, they're usually very alert. They just guide your hand off. If you touch the back of the chair and start it up, they would take a relatively self-determined action to come up and prevent you from dumping them off on the floor. The handling of motion by a person at 2-0 is, as it comes in, change it and get right rid of it. At 2-0 is where we find anything I say to you, I'll say right back. Anything you say to me, I'll say right back to you. I will show you. Pugnacious, echoing. It's echoing, is what it is. Because a motion that comes in, they will put out the motion again. Now, as you come well up the band, you'll find an individual starts taking the motion, looking it over, quick glance, finding out if he can use it or not, dumping it, using it, doing anything he wants to it. Now, there is a motion against motion, and there is emotion plotted against action. You understand that? You must understand that, because you must be able to look at a human being for about 2 seconds and know where they are in the tone scale before they even talk. After they talk, you've got the chart of attitudes and you've got the old chart of science of survival, but you must know where they are in the tone scale if you're going to do some fast action for them, because there's specific things that you do for specific levels of the tone scale now. It's gotten awfully precise, like carpentry or something. All right. Here's this person. They sit down at your desk. You can observe this. It's fabulous. Watch the consistency of human beings on this thing. You sit down at your desk. You offer this person a cigarette, and they take the cigarette rather mechanically, although they don't smoke. Just like that. They'll take the cigarette that's given to them, but they don't smoke. Well, they're down there around grief, upper band apathy. If you give them a cigarette and they don't react to it for a considerable little space of time, and so while you offer them a cigarette, they're in apathy. That motion that you have, well, it can go right on through them anyhow. It doesn't matter. Nothing matters. A person who is angry will see you start to offer him a cigarette, or will even see your hand move. Guess your intention and stop you. He will stop you from talking. He will stop you from acting. He will stop you from moving. Generally, the people who get around individuals who are in chronic anger have been held to motionlessness and are finally blocked. They're right down at the bottom of the tone scale. See how that would be? Because your angry person demands no motion. And by the way, demands no emotional response except complete stop. Now this person, the angry person, says, you must do this and you must do that. Go ahead, just try and do them. Because the second you start to do either one of them, you've got to do something else. A little kid who's around an angry person is in apathy very badly, quite often. You'll find these little kids very sick. Little kid wants to run outdoors and play. That's what he mustn't do. He doesn't want to run outdoors and play. He's got to run outdoors and play. You get the idea. But don't let the little kid get up and put on his shoes and start outdoors and play, because he can't go outdoors. You get the idea? It looks like there's a lot of reasoning behind it, and there's a terrific amount of rationalization as to why they mustn't, but the whole end goal at 1-5 on the tone scale is just stop the motion. Stop it. Obey. Act. Only God help you if you move. Now, as you come up the tone scale, these other manifestations are there. But you can watch people, you can watch them as they walk, you can watch them the way they sit. You can suddenly realize how they're handling motion. And you, right away, you'll pick them up. And they'll be right across the boards for you. Then you know what to run if you're doing something fast for them. All right. There is motion as it impinges on emotion. There's that bridge right there. Now, there's another little gimmick that, unless you've looked at the handbook, you haven't heard of yet. It's not an advanced procedure yet. Counter emotion. There's emotion, and there's counter emotion. And you guessed it, there's thought and counter thought. effort, counter-effort, emotion, counter-emotion, thought, counter-thought. Those are the six categories of life manifestation in the physical universe. And that's evidently all there are. That's neat. Because it's very interesting. You start taking an individual and you tell him to start running counter-thought. And he will pick up more doggone stuff in less time than any God's quantity of old-style processing. It just pours in by the bucketful. Counter-thought. He thinks a thought, somebody else thinks an opposite thought. What? How does it fit with the thoughts? Now, it isn't necessarily that these counter-thoughts are posed as opposed to the individual. What happens to a guy who, with a low tone scale crew, agrees with them all the time? Agree, 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 agree. What happens to a salesman who goes out and he sees Blitz and Company and Smog and Company out in Los Angeles and so on, and he goes around and the fellow says, "I like golf." The salesman, according to his instruction book, has to say, "I like golf too. How is your golf game, Mr. Snide?" Back and forth, and agree, 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 agree. Well, this is counter-thought, but where is it on the tone scale? If you're plotting counter-thought on the tone scale, having to agree with everything that somebody says puts you on the tone scale pretty low. Unless you are agreeing on a level of natural or logical action. For instance, you see that weights and balances act in a certain way. And the professor shows you that weights and balances act in a certain way. And you come along and you say, "Weights and balances act that way." Yeah, I agree with that. You're not agreeing with somebody. You're not agreeing with his mode of presentation. You're agreeing with the physical universe fact. You're just observing that fact. You look at that fact and there's the fact. But if you go along agreeing with everybody you meet, if you just tried that for 24 hours, I guarantee you that you will be out the bottom. Because this is sympathy on ARC level. Because you act as they act. And it gets to be pretty grim. That's why your salesmen crack up. Nearly all of your hot boys that go out selling and do a great job for the first few years eventually head for Lord knows what. Ulcers and migraines and everything else. They hit drink, anything, to snap them out of this. They don't know what's holding them in there, and it's just that counter-thought. Also, a good salesman hits counter-emotion. Any emotion he finds in his environment, he'll agree with it. He finds the boss mad at democracy, he'll get mad at democracy. You understand? He uses that type of counter-emotion. He'll agree with any level of the tone scale in which he finds his potential buyer. And by the way, he really sells them, too. But if he keeps it up too terribly long, he'll polish himself off, practically. Now, he'll even go into the level of effort and counter-effort, so that he will be the effort for every counter-effort. The risk of making some of you blush, that's generally the way they sell a lot of orders in New York City, with having girl salesmen. Golf is typical in that. The salesman goes out and plays golf with somebody in order to sell it. He plays golf, not because he wants to play golf, but because the guy he's trying to sell likes to play golf, and he agrees with this guy he's trying to sell. There he is. So he's putting out an effort to match up the counter. That gets pretty grim. Because you see, he would put himself on the tone scale with every individual he's trying to sell, and some of those people might be as bad off as normal. As a consequence, you see what he would face. So the counter effort merely means the thought, the opposing thought. It can come before or after your own thought. It's just the environmental thought, that's all. However voiced, however written, however felt. Somebody thinks we're going into mysticism. It's just about as mystic, this whole thing, as that table is full of holes, which it isn't. Which, by the way, it actually is. But that datum comes out of nuclear physics, not mysticism. Now, you can extrapolate this thing up and say, well, then there's ESP and there's these other various things. Well, That's in the field of paradianetics. If you want to investigate that on counterthought, thought and counterthought and so forth, you might get somewhere. Believe me, you don't have to get action from a preclear on counterthought. You just start running. Run all the times when somebody else thought something different than what you thought. Of course, you see you're running anger if you do that, because that's completely opposite. Run all the times when somebody got afraid of the things you thought. Run all the times when somebody expressed grief at the things you thought. And get the counter thought. Get what they thought about it. Run all the times when it didn't matter what you thought, in complete apathy. Just run counter thought. Just run their thoughts on this line. You get a lot of action out of a case, believe me. Some individuals can only do just this one. That's about as light as you can get, by the way. Now, let's take emotion. Emotion is a little bit stickier. The bottom band of emotion, you see there's two bands to emotion, the one which goes into thought and the one which goes into action or effort. And the bottom band down here is communicable. That's what causes mass hysteria. One girl in the factory says, "Nyah, saw a mouse." 560 women say, "Nyah," and they don't know why. And they all dash outside. Somebody walks down the street in a southern town, and he says, "White girl, big black buck, so on and so on." You know, he's emotional. All of a sudden, the whole town, blah, 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 all of a sudden, that's mass hysteria. Only let's not make the mistake which was made in the past and call it hysteria, because it isn't there on the tone scale. Hysteria sort of says that it's fear and upset and so forth. Well, that happens to be very easy to communicate, because that's where this mechanism apparently came from. Man is a pack animal, so are deer or herd animals, and so on. And the leader all of a sudden sees something that gives him a jolt, you'll see the whole herd go simultaneously. He doesn't whistle or spit or anything. They're back there, they got their backs to him, they're grazing and so forth. Oh, it was a very handy thing as man came up the generations. The leader turns the corner with great self-confidence and runs back into the teeth of a mammoth. Now, you see, it would actually build up on the genetic facsimile line that the guy in advance would very often be injured, and the others would see it. And, therefore, it gets into the lower band. And if anything broadcasts, it is not thought, it's emotion. We know emotion broadcasts. It's as solid, it's more solid than a radio wave. Counter-emotion, then, can be an apathy. An individual, happy, cheerfully, comes into a crowd of people, and they're all sitting around like this. And after a while, he's sitting around like this. Counter-emotion got him. An individual's perfectly happy, free, cheerful. He just learned about a death, maybe, of a member of the family. He doesn't feel bad about it at all. He suddenly walks in the house. Everybody's crying. Bong. He's right down in grief. Fear. Anger. And on up the tone scale. But there's what happens in a crew of men. You take the top side of a crew of men, if he's in a certain tone level, emotionally. A ship, for instance, has a tendency to feel that all the way through, down to its last rivet. It all acts that way. Very interesting. You take a ship where the bulkier upper strata are pretty jumpy about the situation and so forth, you can look down there on number one gun and you can see the boys down there getting jumpy too. Of course, you can say, well, this happened because of the sound power phones, and this happened because of this, and it happens because of that. But believe me, it happens. Now, you start running counter-emotion on the various band levels of the tone scale for an individual, and you can eventually coax him into feeling it. The lower a person is on the tone scale, the more trouble you are going to have in putting across counter-emotion. Because, of course, in apathy, the individual can endure. That's the prize, you see. Counter emotion, well, doesn't bother me. Goes on by. Oh, no, there isn't. Couldn't be any such thing as counter emotion. I don't understand what you're talking about. You mean I go into the valence of the other person and feel that sort of thing? And I feel their anger, huh? No, no. As you're standing there, can you feel the emotion of the other person? Very simple. You say, oh, you mean my going into their valence? And you say, no. No, you're standing there and you feel an emanation. Here's a pinpoint. That's you. And here's the other person. Now we'll pretend he's a light bulb. And it throws out rays and it hits you. We want you to feel those emotional responses. This other person's angry, and we want you to feel that anger coming at you. Oh, the person says, you mean I go into their valence? Well, you have a hard time explaining it, unless you tell them to run endure, and then they know what you mean. Now, you coax somebody into feeling the counter-emotion of an individual. The counter-emotion of an individual they love very much. Maybe they can't find it for a little while. All of a sudden they'll find a time when it's different from it is what it is normally. And then they'll feel counter-emotion. You can just coax them into finally feeling counter-emotion. You don't have to coax anybody into feeling counter-effort. You just stand them up, hit them in the stomach, and say, that's counter-effort. They say, no. They say, I get it. Now, counter-emotion. Counter-emotion has some interesting manifestations. But you should know what we mean by it. It is simply just like that. We could count on that as another human being, a life form, or any part of any dynamic. Any part of any dynamic. And we could feel an emanation from that somehow or other. I don't care whether you call it atmosphere. Sometimes you start calling it atmosphere and an individual understands it better. Actually, any dynamic gives an atmosphere to an individual. Now, we don't care how this is sensed, whether the person is seeing it, feeling it, hearing it, how he's receiving it. He may try to analyze how he's receiving it, but it's always the same thing. Now, he isn't seeing or feeling it. The upper band of this emotional band, however, is all on the subject of thought. See, emotion being in between the two. Now, thought does not have impact value. But thought, by monitoring an individual's emotion, his own emotion can have an impact value. And thought, by being transmitted to another individual and entering into his emotional system, can have an impact balance. So we've got the methods of communication of emotion. But individuals communicate with individuals more or less with some emotion connected. More or less. Pure communication by thought, no matter how done, would be without emotion. You take individuals working in the physical sciences are quite often very happy to work in the physical sciences because they don't have to have anything to do with anything that has a very strong counter-emotion. They duck on such a thing. Now, the only thing, the only real liability to an individual in auditing, not counter-thought, it's counter-emotion. You take some auditor, for instance, who's scared to run grief. He just won't run grief off of a pre-clear, and that's that. He just doesn't want any of it, that's all. He knows a counter-emotion hits him out. What are people afraid of? The auditor is not afraid that the pre-clear is going to get up off the couch and hit him over the head with a brick bat. And he's not really going to be terribly afraid, unless he has a bad engram on the subject, that the pre-clear has thoughts about him. By the way, there's a whole psychotherapy that has to do with psychiatric psychosis that, now, you're thinking about me, aren't you? You're doubting me, aren't you? And they're only happy when they can get the patient to think or doubt or something. You know? All right. What are people at large in the world afraid of? When I say afraid, that's right on that hysterical band, isn't it? But what don't they want to face in the society around them? 9 times out of 10, when you tell them, well, you don't like the feel of somebody being angry. What don't you like about somebody being angry? They give you a lot of explanation about it, but they don't like the feel of it. They don't like the feel of somebody being scared. Now, they say that dogs can smell people who are scared. You know as auditors that you can smell somebody who's scared. Because people get that scared sometimes. All right.